You're listening live to the sixth official episode of the Arman and Akil Show, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policymakers from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Arman Rana. It's Saturday, the 15th of July, 2023, at 5:08 p.m. We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hankamian-speaking Musqueam people. Today, we are going to take an excursion into Pakistan, understanding its economy, its history, its economy, and its people. To assist us with this, we have Asma Hashmi. Asma Hashmi is a PhD candidate from SFU in political economy and a keen observer of South Asian politics. Asma, to start us off, thanks. First of all, thanks so much for coming on the program. And could you just start us off by telling us a bit more about yourself and why you chose to study political science?
So thank you for having me on the show. So why did I choose to study? So my basic degree, my master's was in economics. So, and that was from Pakistan. I taught economics for a bit as well. So when I came here, tried to apply, always wanted to study and, you know, had this quest for knowledge and curiosity. So when I wanted to apply, the university said, we won't accept your degree, even though my degree was from one of the best universities in Pakistan. But they said, we won't consider your master's a master's.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, so I thought, okay, so if I, you know, just being adventurous, I thought if I, you know, need to study further, why not study political economy and go... So that would allow me to study, to go behind the economics and study the philosophy and the, you know, those things from where economics comes from. So I went into IR, political science, because that's where the political economy, international development was studied. So my main interest is in international political economy and international development.
So how is international political economy different than, like, what does it mean? What does that mean for, like, a random person on the street? What does international political economy actually mean?
So political economy would be as compared to political science, or...
Yeah, like maybe say I'm a 5-year-old kid and you're trying to explain to me what is political economy.
So political economy, like economics you study, you know, the markets, the how the economy works. So you do the cost benefit analysis, you do the so you're actually studying the but with political economy you are studying how politics also affects the economy. And how the, you know, they're not sort of separate. Politics and economics are not separate. So you study them. For a 5-year kid, I would say focus on better things.
That's funny. So by then, the international political economy becomes the impact of international politics on the economy, or?
So we call it global political economy as well. So that would be looking at, you know, how the whole, the world system works rather than, you know, so if, for example, if you're studying Pakistan, you would also be looking at how the global markets work. So, you know, how, you know, you would be studying the global institutions who make the policies, and you'll be looking at it from a broader perspective rather than just a local national one.
I see. Makes sense. So, you know, you're talking a bit about your personal life. How has your, you know, experience you know, as an immigrant, colored your perspective on Pakistan's politics and economy, and its relation to the rest of the world?
How has my experience? You know, it's been a learning curve. You come, I mean, invariably, when you come to a different place, you know, you start doing this comparative kind of thing. You know, that's, oh, look how things are working here and how things were working back there. For example, university. I mean, when I went to the university, so you know how teaching was being done here compared to back home, you know, where I was at a university. Even though the professors we had were all from Ivy League universities, had done their PhDs from there. I mean, there was a difference in discipline as well, economics and political science, of course. You know, with political science, there are more debates going on and there are always sides to take and always, you know. So, you know, you do compare. So how has that added? I mean, the immigrant experience plus the academic, I'd say, experience. You know, you start to analyze things. You start to look.
So what was the difference, like, that you noticed in the teaching style, for example, like between here and in Pakistan?
So here there were more options available. So, for example, in Pakistan, I mean, maybe things were different in other disciplines. But economics, you know, you had a set course. You had a number of, you know, you didn't have too many options of courses to take. But here you can, you know, go to other departments as well. I mean, you do have to take your core courses and everything. But, you know, for example, I can go to the communications department, take a course there, you know, go to the, you know, so it's more options available to you.
And, you know, just generally, like, what, this is somewhat a personal question, but what motivated you to, you know, to move from Pakistan, especially when you experienced, you know, some level of discrimination in terms of your credentials not being validated, which is similar to the experience of my own parents. But, you know, like, what motivated you to make that leap in your family?
So in my case, I mean, obviously, everyone has their own story to tell. But in my case, it was a very personal sort of thing. I was going through, you know, a bit of a difficult phase. And so I just needed a break. So I thought, okay, let me go. Let's apply to. And, you know, everyone at that point was applying to Canada. And I was like, okay. Let's apply, go to Canada and, you know, stay there for a bit and maybe we can come back, take our break and come back. So, you know, this was like, this was the thought process at that time. And there's also this thing, you know, in Pakistan, I'm not sure about other countries, but our passport is... you know, it becomes a bit of a hassle to get visas to different places. So, you know, it was like, okay, it will be good for the kids, a different experience. So that's how we came. Always thinking we'll stay, you know, we won't, you know, we'll go back. But it's been now... long time, and you know, I guess life takes its own course. You plan, and life has a plan for you.
Yeah, for sure. And but like I do wonder, you know, coming back to my earlier question, that story, you said everybody was looking at Canada. That was probably somewhat of an economic. There's probably an economic element to that as well. The fact that, you know, so many people, especially educated people, are looking to, you know, leave their homeland. I think there's similar phenomena that took place in India at different points in time. Could you talk a bit about that? And
so, yeah, I mean, the economic prospects, of course, are a charm and, you know, you think you might be able to do. But in my case, I think my husband had a good job. We were doing well, you know, had a good social life, everything. So that wasn't really it was really, you know, trying to experience the world and, you know, generally to explore. And in fact, I think we've taken a bit of an economic financial hit by by moving.
Yeah.
At least that's what my family keeps telling me.
Yeah, I think that's actually a very common story. I think it's often for the next generation to give them more economic opportunities than, or even like, you know, experience opportunities than the, you know, the older generation. So, yeah, well, I think it's a good time for an ad break. So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Arman and Akhil show. Akhil isn't here today. He's gone off to Seattle for some reason. This is on CITR 101.9 FM. In this episode, we are looking both forward into Pakistan's future, how it is, you know, recovering from, for example, the recent devastating floods, and also its past since independence, with, you know, focus on the economy and the international relations that Pakistan has had over the years. We'll be continuing with that after a short ad break. Stay tuned.
Kick off Pride celebrations with a show full of awesome local talent. Come watch the iconic Devours performing with special guests Masank, Soyjoy, and Tough Sell at Green Auto Body's outdoor stage on August 4th. Doors are at 7 p.m. and this event is 19+. For tickets and more information, you can go to the Eventbrite page, which can be found in the link of devours.ufo's Instagram. This is an event you won't want to miss out on.
Do you love to read, but your friends and family are tired of you droning on and on about your latest book? Well, forget them, because you have me now. Hi, I'm Randy from Dog-Eared Radio Book Club, a book club coming to you through the airwaves from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. every 2 weeks on Tuesday evenings on CITR 101.9 FM. Tune in to hear the rambling thoughts of a fellow reader that are factually supported by my co-host of the week. Follow the show on Instagram at Dog-Eared Radio Book Club to find out about our next read.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Arman and Akhil show on CITR 101.9 FM. We are speaking with Asma Hashmi on the political economy of Pakistan. So now we're going to take a bit of a closer look at Pakistan, what's happening recently. But before we do that, we also want to go a bit into the past. Kind of, I think a lot of people don't have a great understanding of the history of Pakistan, where it came from, how it relates to the other countries in the region. So we're going to play a few clips from maybe interesting figures in Pakistan's colorful history and kind of discuss them. So the first clip we have is a clip from the founder of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah. Pakistan was founded in 1947. And we're going to take a listen to this clip after.
I know. The people of America are deeply interested in India. I send you my cordial greetings on behalf of the Muslim India, and I feel we have your good wishes. As you know, of the many races, creeds and religions that inhabit the vast subcontinent of India, there are two major nations, the Hindus and Muslims. funded millions of Muslims cannot be characterized as a minority. We are 70 millions in the northwestern and northeastern zones of India. We constitute a majority of 70% against the caste Hindus in these homelands of ours. We want the division of India into Hindustan and Pakistan because that is the only practical solution which will secure freedom for both Hindus and Muslims and the achievement of stable and enduring governments of Hindustan and Pakistan.
So yeah, I just want to get your reaction to that. And just provide some context on, you know, who Jinnah was and to what degree that vision that he was outlining has been fulfilled.
So Jinnah, of course, a much respected figure, considered the father of the nation. He's called Qaid-e-Azam, which means the great leader. And he sort of came late to the independence movement, but this thing about the two-nation theory had been going on before Jinnah, and that he adopted. And you know, there's this sort of a bit of to complicate things a bit, this thing about Hindus and Muslims being two nations has been sort of challenged by sort of historians like, if I don't know if you've heard of a very famous Indian historian, Romila Thapar.
No, I haven't heard of them, but
so
yes.
She sort of says that this thing about Hindus and Muslims being two nations is a theory that sort of came with the colonials, and especially J.S. Mill, who sort of started saying, I mean, certainly they were.
So who is J.S. Mill?
So J.S. Mill, a famous political philosopher, a British, very famous philosopher, famous for his utilitarian
theories. Okay, you know, I know Mill. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. John S. Mill.
Yeah.
So they, you know, these British intellectuals of that time were writing about India as well, and you know, whether India should have independence, whether, you know, they are mature enough or civilized enough to, you know. So that was going on. So Hindu and Muslims, you know, certainly have their differences, but they had been living together for a number of years. So, you know,
yes, but just, you know, who was Jinnah? So he adopted this two-nation theory that he said, you know, even now people, you know, dispute. And I kind of get that, because just from a cultural lens, you know, North Indians and people in Pakistan, in terms of food, in terms of clothing, in terms of language,
right,
are very similar compared
to
how people look
of India,
compared to the south of India, right, or to the northeast,
right,
or even the, you know, the east where it, you know, right, Bangladesh and whatever is going on there. So I, you know, I understand, like, you could slice things in many different ways.
Yeah, I guess here, yeah, what I was trying to, yeah, get at was that this concept of nation.
Yeah.
So you know, whether the Muslims were a fully formed, because, you know, nation has a long history,
yeah,
and how sort of, you know, the, for example, even in the Western countries, how nation states came about, and how,
yeah,
you know. So in that sense, I guess, yeah, I was trying to say there were certainly different communities.
So how did she make that argument? You said that, you know, that historian you mentioned made
Romila
the argument.
Thapar.
Yeah, made the argument. So what that they were not two separate nations. So what was that based on?
So her thing was that historically they had, for example, you know, you had Hindu rajas who had Muslim generals in,
yeah,
their armies. You had Muslim, the Mughals, who,
yeah,
had Indian.
Akbar Birbal, who are...
Yeah, you know, yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's all these things. I mean, our history, I guess, has become very controversial, and especially, you know, in India right now as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Revisiting history. But I, what I was highlighting was this concept of nation.
Yeah.
And one thing I guess Pakistan is still struggling with, to you know, because it's a very multi-ethnic nation.
So could you talk a bit about that? Like, in what sense is Pakistan a multi-ethnic nation?
So, and I guess that's what quite a few post-colonial countries have that, because, yeah. you know, they didn't go through that historical process of homogenization that the Western, you know, like you see in the Western, like European states, or even in Canada, you'll see a more homogenized, you know. But in countries like Pakistan, for example, India has the same. You have the Punjabis, you have the Pathans, you have the Balochis. So it's more of a multi-nation state rather than a nation state. Which is, see, it's also what concepts we use to think about our countries. And sometimes those concepts are sort of imported and don't really reflect the reality of our countries. So, you know, for example, a country like Pakistan, I would call it a multi-nation state. And now how do you govern that? How, you know, that's where politics come into play, because politics is all about, you know, give and take, and, you know, so how do you govern? So, for example, languages, you have different, you know, you have Punjabi, you have Pashto, you have Sindhis. So how do you, you know?
So do you think, so, you know, coming back to, you know, that statement, do you think that today, where Pakistan is today, do you think that's in line with the kind of intent or the vision that maybe not just Jinnah, but people had of Pakistan at that point in time? Or in what way does it deviate from that? Or I think what you're saying was that vision itself was maybe made on shaky logical foundations.
I mean, as far as the concept of, I'm not saying, see, I'm not negating or getting into or questioning the division or anything. I'm not going there. That's another story. Yeah. I was just sort of picking on this concept of nation.
Yeah.
That, you know, we have to complicate that. And see that, you know, so you know, you say Hindus and Muslims were different nations, but that nation formation that happens, you know, I guess they hadn't fermented into that kind of nations as such.
But even now, you don't think that it's still, from your perspective, it's still a multi-nation, right? That's what you're saying. Pakistan till today is a multi-nation.
I would say that,
state.
And I would say that can be your strength and the beauty that you know, like, you know, as our friend Karl Marx said, that capitalism sort of, you know, destroys all these things, and you become homogenized. And so I think the fact that our countries retain these ethnicities, you know, because every ethnicity has their own language. Language carries their history, their, you know, they have their own crafts, they have their own ways of hospitality, for example, or ways of, you know, engaging with each other. And so I think it can be a very beautiful thing to have.
Yeah,
that kind of diversity.
Yeah, cool. Okay, so I think we've beaten that clip to death. Let's move to our next clip. So the next one is from one of the military leaders Pakistan, Ayub Khan.
Right.
From, I think, 1965. So we're still going back in time some ways.
Presents the President's Address to the Nation on the 1st of September and special stories of ruthless Indian aggression in Kashmir.
My dear countrymen, Assalamu alaikum. I am speaking to you tonight under the threat of war in Kashmir, which is being forced on us by India. The exchange of desultory fire, which had been going on for months across the ceasefire line in Jammu and Kashmir, has now assumed a grimmer aspect. In certain sectors, the armies of two countries have clashed. Failing to suppress the freedom fighters in the occupied territory of Jammu and Kashmir, India has embarked on a course of aggression across the ceasefire line. Indian artillery firing across the border on August 23rd hurled several shells into village Awan of Gujarat district, destroying houses and killing 20 innocent people and injuring another 15. The world might well ask why the Indians are so anxious to precipitate this war. The answer is simple. The Indian rulers find that their adventure in imperialism, which started with the subjugation of Junagadh and Hyderabad and later brought Goa under their occupation, is in serious jeopardy in Kashmir. The people of Jammu and Kashmir, who had been living under Indian colonial oppression, have risen in open revolt. India.
Yeah, I think that clip goes on for a life, but I think we got the general gist of it. Do you want to give some, you know, context for, you know, that conflict? But also just the reason I included it is because, you know, the military has always been a powerful political force in Pakistan. And I just wanted to get an impression of why do you think that is the case?
Why military is... such a big force in Pakistan.
Yeah. How did that come about?
So when India and Pakistan, you know, got decolonized and got separated into these two states, India and Pakistan, and at that point, you have to remember that there was what was called East Pakistan, which is the contemporary Bangladesh, so separated by thousands of miles of land. So here was West Pakistan, and there was this, you know, thousands of miles of India in between, and then you have Bangladesh. So the I guess the formula for the division of India was that the Muslim majority areas would form the new state of Pakistan, and Bangladesh was also a Muslim majority area. So they that became sort of East Pakistan and West Pakistan, and I guess the British were clever. They sort of gave the independence, but they always had this divide and rule policy. So, you know, they left some of these border issues for the two countries to keep playing with. So Kashmir was one of those, you know. So, I mean, and it is to this day. So we have what we call the... Pakistani, or what we call Kashmir. Indians call it, you know, that it's sort of occupied by Pakistan. We call the, you know, the Kashmir that's, I mean, it's unfortunate for the Kashmir, actually,
yeah,
that it's become this beautiful place that has become this site of conflict. And you know, I sort of, and, you know, there's been lots of stuff going on in, so the Indian held, what we call the Indian held Kashmir. And, you know, of course, so it's still very controversial. India, of course, claims that
they
are going to take back this Kashmir from Pakistan. And Pakistan, for the longest time, had made Kashmir, Kashmir's independence, sort of a main part of its foreign policy. That's sort of the...
So that's the reason, you think, is that the reason as to why the military became...
No. That's not... I was just generally sort of... I thought you were just asking me to explain why there are two Kashmirs. So, why Pakistan? So when Pakistan got its independence, the areas that that sort of became Pakistan, for example, Balochistan, Sindh, Punjab, and what was then called NWFP, Northwestern Frontier Provinces, which has now been renamed to Pakhtunkhwa, which means the land of the Pashtuns. And we also had this place called Fata, which is the federally administered tribal areas. So that was sort of kept as, a sort of a buffer zone by the British. So it was like, you know, we'll let the tribals have lives as long as they keep the Afghans at bay.
Exactly. So just for our listeners, the term tribals is kind of a similar concept, kind of different to the indigenous people of South Asia.
Tribals?
Yeah. How would you explain? Because the concept doesn't really, like, they're the people who've been there the longest period of time, right? I don't know, how would you translate that concept to a North American audience?
See, tribes, when you talk... Again, one of those tricky words that sort of seems to, because you have tribes in sort of India, which are very different. You know, you have tribals in India. Like you're saying, you have the indigenous population here. But those tribal areas, I guess they were like, you know, because... I don't know why they called them tribes. I have no idea, honestly. But, you know,
So you're saying that basically it was a buffer zone to keep the
Afghans at bay?
Yeah.
Because, you know, so the British said, you know, on that border, because they had fought some wars with the Afghans and hadn't succeeded. So they let these tribals, I guess, because they... are a community, they have their own sort of laws.
Way of life.
So they go according to what their traditional, for example, justice. So they won't go to the British courts for justice. They'll have their own jirga system where the elders of the community would get together and decide on whatever the local traditions were. So the British, you know, let them keep that...
Autonomy. So you're continuing in your explanation of why the military is...
Military, there was this thing that India, you know, there was, I guess, a sort of insecurity, like, you know, India is not going to... let us keep our independence. It might want to take us over. So those were... because immediately Pakistan and India fought some wars as well, immediately after partition. Whether true or not, but that was the kind of, you know, like an insecurity that we are very small compared to India. And to make our... to secure our borders, we need a strong military, and you also have to realize that a lot of people, there was a lot of migration that happened when India and Pakistan were partitioned. So a lot of these civil servants, bureaucrats, came from India. And, you know, there was also this thing that now we have to, govern the local people as well as sort of protect our borders from these projected enemies like India.
So that's like it was because of this foreign policy, you know, goals. To some degree, a lot of resources went to the military, and that's why how they became so powerful. Is that
so? So I guess those were the insecurities that Pakistan started off with. You know, a new nation didn't have those areas that became Pakistan didn't really have a big industrial base. I mean, Karachi was there, but, you know, so there was this, like, we have to develop the industry as well, and we have to do all these things. Plus, you also have to realize that that was coincided with the onset of the Cold War. And the Cold War, US needed allies. You know, so, you know, it's a very sort of this thing that during the Cold War, the US supported a lot of dictators, a lot of military regimes, because there was this thing that...
So Ayub Khan would fall into that category.
Sorry?
Well, this Ayub Khan would fall into that category of, you know, being supported as some sort of Cold War.
I would say so, because Ayub Khan, you know, even wrote a book called Friends, Not Masters, about the U.S.-Pakistan thing that, you know, we have a, you know, we are allying with the U.S., but they're not our masters. We are not, you know, they are our friends. Yeah. So that was the title of his book. But so U.S. had this fear, you know, what is called the domino effect, that, you know, there's USSR and all these newly developed nations might go the communist way. So, you know, to keep the local, I guess, populations in, you know, in I guess to keep peace for them to not go the communist route, we need some strong men to be governing these countries. And so Ayub Khan sort of sided with the US, got a lot of funding from them and stuff. So I guess that was sort of, so from the beginning, Pakistan sort of, you know, the main concern was that we have to safeguard our security, our borders. And, you know, it was, I guess also to, how to keep the internal peace as well. And so, you know, these places that became Pakistan didn't have, you know, I guess didn't have that kind of institutions there. And military was the biggest. I mean, the civil service were there as well, but military became, you know, with the Cold War, with siding with the US, because we need to make sure that India doesn't take us over. So, you know, security became the main concern. And
so the next clip that we have is a clip from, can I ever pronounce his name correctly? I'm going to butcher it. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto.
Right.
Announcing the nationalization of key industries in Pakistan. You probably have maybe heard this clip before, given your...
Bhutto has some very, very charismatic person, had some very... He has this one very interesting... I don't know if you have that clip here or not. Because India and... so what was West Pakistan? Pakistan and sort of had this war in 1971.
You're talking about the one from the United Nations where he
So in 1971, what was West Pakistan became Bangladesh after a war was fought. And Pakistan sort of lost in that war. And that's why they had to cede, you know, that independence to the Bangladeshis. And to this day, honestly, it's a mystery to me why Bangladesh wasn't given, you know, if they could have separated, you know, made Pakistan a state, India was there, why not give that same status to Bangladesh from the beginning?
Yeah, but it was a bizarre structure, like geographically, right?
Yeah, exactly. So Bhutto has this very sort of thing where he goes to the United Nations and he sits there and he tears up those papers and says, you know, keep these. I don't know. He had this very interesting thing. I don't remember his statement exactly, but you have to see that.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to include it today.
Yeah, if anyone is interested, should.
But it's
on YouTube. They should Google it and see.
I'm going to play it.
Security
I'll play
Council.
It now. I'm going to play it now. I think I found it. Let's see. Not this one. Yeah, this is the one.
Have a treaty impose any decision. Have a treaty worse than the Treaty of Versailles. Legalize aggression. Legalize occupation. Legalize everything that has been illegal till 14th or 15th of December 1971. I will not be a party to it. My country hearkens for me. Why should I waste my time here in the Security Council?
Yeah, and he's just storming out of the Security Council for our listeners after ripping up a piece of paper.
Right.
You can see he's very impassioned. The clip I was going to play, actually, he's a lot more mellow.
I disrupted.
No, it's a very good clip. I'm glad we got to play it. I wanted to play it as well.
I had made a pledge to the people of Pakistan to implement important industrial reforms in the country. I am now beginning to redeem this pledge. As from today, the control and command of the people over the following categories of industries have been asserted. 1, iron and steel industries. 2, basic metal industries. 3, heavy engineering industries. 4, heavy electrical industries. 5, assembly and manufacture of motor vehicles. 6, tractor plants, assembly and manufacture. 7, heavy and basic chemicals. 8, petrochemicals.
So I think we kind of get the idea. What was that about? And how did that change, or did it not change, the economic trajectory of Pakistan? And could you talk just a little bit more? Focused very much on the kind of foreign policy aspects. What was the economic story going on in Pakistan?
So under Ayub Khan, so that was sort of, if you are familiar with what is called the modernization theory.
What is the modernization?
So modernization theory was, all these... during the 1947, 1950s, a lot of these states in Africa, all over the place, who were under different colonial rules, had become independent. Now, suddenly, colonial sort of history was becoming invisible, and suddenly there was this sense that these are new nations, you know, they have to be developed. And so you had what was called the modernization theory. And modernization theory was that all these newly... And, you know, Pakistan also came under it. I mean, it wasn't specifically for Pakistan, but for all the newly independent nations, which were in Africa as well. And, you know, so there was this thing that these nations are underdeveloped And so, you know, you see the colonial narrative now changes to this new narrative that these new nations, they have to be developed, they have to be modernized. So you had the modernization theory. So modernization theory was that the West will help these new countries by giving them technology, by giving them financial support. And, you know, so we'll provide the blueprint for how their economies should be developed and, you know, how they should industrialize. And so that was the modernization theory. And under Ayub Khan, you know, that's called the developmental decade in Pakistan's history. There was a lot of, industrialization. Pakistan was economically doing well, politically, socially, of course, another matter. But, you know, there was this sense that, you know, and those are called the development decades. So where was I going with this?
Yeah,
so sorry, I lost track.
Yeah, Bhutto's Bhutto.
So we come. So then, subsequently, of course, Ayub Khan was thrown out. He was a military dictator. So, you know, there were lots of protests and everything. He was thrown out. There was subsequently a war. In which India also supported Bangladesh, and, you know, you had, of course, and so, you know, so as a nation, I guess, Pakistan had to recover from that defeat, and Bhutto comes in, this charismatic figure who says, you know, it's okay if we, you know, if they've gone their own way or we've lost the war, but, you know, so we carry on. So he used to make very charismatic speeches. His famous slogan was roti, kapra, or makan, which means roti means bread, kapra means clothing,
yeah.
And makan, shelter. So, you know, those basics. So he had that sort of socialist kind of rhetoric going on. I say rhetoric because the actual policies were not actually very socialist as such or redistributive.
I see.
As such, but you know, so he you know, had that slogan, and he would he made very charismatic speeches. So he went on this thing about.
And you were in Pakistan at this time.
I was in Pakistan. Yes. Yeah.
So you were like a teenager or something growing up.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, so
hearing his speeches on the
radio. I was like, Bhutto, I was younger than a teenager, okay. But Bhutto's speeches actually, I don't remember from that time,
yeah.
But I remember from, like, you know, watching them later when Bhutto was not there. But I do remember I was there when Bhutto was hanged.
I see.
So, you know, so Bhutto comes in. We'll get to that as well. But so Bhutto comes in. He has, you know, the morale is down. Army has lost this war. So, you know, he embarks on this kind of very, so roti, kapra, or makan, and we'll give everyone food and shelter and all that. And so one of his, I think, a short-sighted policy. And, you know, at that time, you have to realize, I mean, I'm not trying to, not to complicate the story, but you have to realize that behind all these policies and what's going on, there's also an academic thinking that's sort of generating policies.
Of course.
So that's why I mentioned the modernization theory policies. So these were like, you know, not organic policies that, you know.
So would you put nationalization into one of those?
So nationalization was, I won't put them, because modernization sort of thinking was coming from this, North America, yeah. think tanks and stuff.
But
so nationalization would be more of a USSR yeah, kind of yeah. Thing. So, you know, and yeah. with these countries, I guess the policymakers were picking and choosing and getting this sort of confused kind of mix. And so nationalization wasn't part of the, you know, that yeah. that would but be more of a liberal, neoliberal yeah. kind of.
What was the impact of that?
Why I brought in the academics was because at that time there was a famous Pakistani economist working at the UN and working closely with Amartya Sen, the yeah. famous economist. And so Mehboob ul Haq had this thing that, you know, 20 families in Pakistan own 90% or 99% of its wealth. And so that kind of thinking was there. He had written a book that these 20 families, and Bhutto sort of, you know, was decided to crack down on those 20 families and decided to nationalize, like he's saying, yeah. this, you know, the most of the things. Of course, that nationalization did not work. He had to reverse that.
I see.
But I think that, I may be wrong, but my own sort of analysis of that is that that really took its toll on the Pakistan economy. Because, you know, a lot of these, and if I can add a personal kind of yeah. anecdote to this, recently I talked to a friend of mine. So we were talking about Bhutto's nationalization and, you know, all this stuff. I mean, a lot of projects that Bhutto sort of financed. There was a roti plant that was supposed to make rotis and provide subsidized rotis, didn't really work out. You know, lots of things. And here you have to realize that he's nationalizing these industries, but one of the biggest sort of needs of Pakistan was to really have land reforms and redistribute the land. But, you know, Bhutto being a feudal landlord himself didn't go that route. But so nationalization, talking to, I think that took a toll because these were, most of these people were business communities who had migrated from India trying to help Jinnah establish industry in Pakistan. And, you know, so a friend of mine who belonged to one of the, whose grandfather belonged to one of the 20 families, she said, you know, her father had brought all his assets to Pakistan, you know, yeah. At partition. He had come from Calcutta. And overnight, Bhutto nationalizes and he sort of, you know, loses everything. So he was really disheartened that, you know, I had come to Pakistan really trying to build up the economy, and Bhutto nationalizes it overnight. So I think that was...
Yeah, so discouraged investment, I guess, in some cases. So there's so much more to talk about. We've actually gone over time.
Oh, my God.
So I've never done that before. But thank you so much for coming on the show. So for our listeners, the music you heard in the intro is actually... brand new beat. It's called Goanese Cashew Drink. It was literally handcrafted for us by a close friend of the show, the unbelievably gifted Sarah Pratt. You may be wondering what I mean by handcrafted. I have no idea. But you can listen to more of her on SoundCloud at Leisure Noise. You can find us at the Harmonical on Instagram and Twitter. So do check us out there. And yeah, do continue to listen. You can find all of our episodes on our podcast feeds, including our recent interviews with City Councillor Christine Boyle and the historian Daniel Francis. So do check it out. Thanks so much to Asma for joining us on the show this evening.
Thank you, Arman, for having me. And the story we have to leave in the middle.
Yeah,
we just got into the, really the middle
one.
Of the story.
Yeah, this is chapter
one. But thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you, everyone, and hope you have an amazing night.